exacte de votre région ou d'une région à proximité est rouge. Afin de limiter la propagation de la COVID-19, les rassemblements d'amis ou de famille dans les résidences et cours privées sont interdits et les déplacements vers d'autres régions sont à éviter. De plus, il est défendu de quitter son domicile entre 21h30 et 5h le matin. Visitez québec.ca/coronavirus pour connaître les mesures en place pour lutter contre la COVID-19. Respectez toutes les règles, tout le temps, sans exception. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
It's time for Audio Smut. Oh god, I'm so fucking wet. Yeah. Yeah. Like that. Like that. Oh god.
You're listening to Audio Smut. My name is Mycelium, and this is Mycophilia. This is the third expression of my messy mycophilic research process. I'm gathering you here today for some good old-fashioned propaganda. Ecosexual propaganda. My goal is simple. Make you horny for nature, hard for environmental justice, and wet for water. My little twist on the ecosexual agenda is a focus on fungi, which has led me to explore concepts of queer mycology and mushroom erotics. When invoking these concepts, I don't claim them. I credit every single mycophile I've ever met or read because they feed this desire, this love story. Like mushrooms, we spread our spores and they land in unpredictable ways. We contaminate each other here in the mycosphere. We sense a call and we answer. We are all minuscule hyphae, trying to feed something bigger, and we invite you in. I must also credit and thank indigenous land defenders and water protectors all across the world, and especially the ones caring for the place where I have the great privilege of standing and where CKUT is broadcasted, Jodjagi, colonially known as Montreal, an unceded Ganyangahaga territory. Throughout the show, I'll be speaking about environmental justice, but environmental justice is impossible without indigenous leadership and governance. Despite comprising less than 5% of the world's population because of genocide and assimilation, indigenous people protect 80% of global biodiversity. Anyone who cares about protecting the earth must invest as much time and energy towards decolonization. Because without the end of imperialism, white supremacy, and extractive capitalism, environmental justice is by definition impossible. In the summer of 2019, I got quite high on psilocybin mushrooms with friends at an older friend's country house. Being a seasoned host, he had let out interesting literature for us to rummage through while tripping. Erotic poetry, a Céline and Renée wedding special, and a copy of Collection Terre à Terre's Guide d'Initiation à la Cueillette des Champignons Sauvages. The latter stood out to me, I think because of the cover, which showed a confident young girl holding a mushroom almost as big as herself. I saw something in her which resonated with me, and it prompted me to force everyone, as they were coming down, to listen to me read it aloud. This moment changed the course of my life. I remember feeling entranced by what I was learning, and repeating ecstatically that I was dropping whatever I was doing to become a mycologist, to which my friends laughed and rolled their eyes. But 2 years later, my enthusiasm has not diminished. I remain mesmerized and, frankly, enamored. Let me try and tell you why. Let's start with some context. The Anthropocene, or better aptly named Capitalocene or Plantationocene, is a proposed epoch characterized by the impact of human activity on the Earth's geology and ecosystems, in which we're certainly living right now, but which starting point remains a scientific debate Some argue that it goes as far back as the advent of sedentary agricultural practices, 12,000 to 15,000 years ago, while others believe it was announced by 1945's Trinity test, the first atomic bomb ever dropped. I'm personally in favor of choosing 1492 as a starting date, in which the arrival of European colonizers in the Caribbean, the subsequent annexing of the Americas, and the first global trade networks created the largest human population replacement in history, caused by the mixing of previously separate biotas and, of course, colonial violence. Within 200 years, war, disease, enslavement, and famine killed tens of millions of people. Comorbid to human subjugation and genocide, the next 500 years saw an exponential devastation of the environment, aggravated by the four industrial revolutions and, starting from the third, qualified as the Great Acceleration. Now at the dusk of the fourth industrial revolution and dawn of the fifth, as the global temperature and number of extinct species peak higher every day, we unstoppably spiral towards unbearable weather, the rise of sea levels, and the inevitable consequence of these dramatic changes, the massive displacement of populations from desertic or inundated regions towards the last remaining livable territories. What is expected to happen if dense crowds of people are forced to fight over scarce land, water, and food to survive? War, of course. But on a monumental scale, only this globalized version of the world could bear witness to. This is bound to happen in the next century if the capitalist industrial society is drastically and globally halted. But considering the human tendency to walk the path of least resistance, we can safely predict this dystopian future is only decades away. It appears justified, once confronted with this terrifying prophecy, to give up on hope and disengage from the future. Yet, for a growing number of people in the global south, these extreme weather events are already a grim reality, while simultaneously the presumed threat of climate refugee incursions is used to effect a securitization that targets migrants themselves. War is always already happening. We're talking about this as if people weren't forced to fight over scarce land, water, and food to survive already. Woefully freaking out for a hypothetical apocalypse without actively working on protecting what is still alive is counterproductive and informed by privilege. As Grace Dillon puts it, the native apocalypse, if contemplated seriously, has already taken place. We are not swimming in pre-apocalyptic anxiety. We are living in the post-apocalyptic present. So, with an inevitable climate catastrophe on our hands, and knowing that the global north, and particularly its upper class, thrives on global south resource extractivism and human labor exploitation, itself a perpetuation of slavery, how can one remain hopeful?
Coyote, coyote, what have they done? Little brother, where do you run? They strychnine the mountain. They strychnine the plain. My little brother, the coyote, won't come back again. When you hear him singing, the few that are left, he's warning the human race of his death. Don't poison flowers and the mazes. Don't poison the sky, or you won't be back, little brother. Goodbye. There will be no one to listen, and no one to sing, and never will
As Donna Haraway points out, the sky is not fallen yet. There is still so much biodiversity to protect and justice to be made. I like to put grit against hope, because for me, hope is this impossible longing, this desire without resolution. Whereas grit is perseverance despite hopelessness. It's resilience through the motions. And grit is a quality that the mushroom certainly possesses. It lives to live on. It will adapt to any circumstances, even ruins. Another quality which the mushroom possesses is humility. Fungi is classified as being part of the low species, along with microbes and bacteria. Yet it sustains all other life forms by breaking down organic matter and dissolving rock to create soil. They are underground, in the dark, in humidity, and that's where the magic happens. In the shadow, away from the spotlight. These little guys do all the dirty work, yet they don't demand recognition and attention. They are subtle and discreet, and one needs to pay attention to notice them. In human terms, this translates as follows. Everybody wants a revolution, but no one wants to do the dishes. The shadow side, the supporting role, the one that does dishes, can be adopted willfully, with intent, joy, pleasure, desire. Supporting from below is great if you're a bottom. And in a way, aren't we all life's bottoms? The mushroom as you know it is only a tiny fragment, the tip of the iceberg of the fungi, of which most is buried underground, the mycelium. Hyphae are tiny filaments which together process soil and advance, growing the size of the mycelium. The final consolidation of mycelium forms a mushroom at the end of its life cycle, which goes on to spread its spores, to survive and perpetuate itself, to continue the cycle. So in a way, from a certain angle, fungi is this magician of death, whose hyphae alchemically break down the soil's matter, integrate it, and transform it into itself, becoming mycelium, and building into a fruiting body above soil, into the realm of the living. Take a minute to observe a mushroom next time you pass one by. Really watch it carefully, and notice how it stands right there under the delicate veil between living and dying. The mushroom dissolves, melts, recycles death. It gives birth again and again, eating, creating, eating, creating, eating, creating, eating, creating. We have much in common. On a molecular level, mushrooms are closer in constitution to human flesh than to plants. There's something erotic about them. It's hard to describe. They're simultaneously fascinating and terrifying. They ride this fine line between disgust and arousal, fear and desire, Eros and Thanatos. With flowers, the moving factor is the apprehension of death. Burgeoning is a slow but steady progress, which we can spy on for weeks until the flower can contain itself anymore, bursting its many folds and hues for the world to see and smell. It's breathtaking, and it's about to wilt. The bloom is short, but spectacular. Trees even have the decency not to flower simultaneously in order to share the spotlight. With mushrooms, on the other hand, once you see them, they're already far in the final chapter of their life. They've already stepped into the realm in between. This revelation on the edge of death and decay has a tragic je ne sais quoi. What can I say? Mushrooms are cool, sexy, and goth. You can't change my mind. It's frustratingly difficult to explain this, to put it into words. Translation is a central theme of the relationship with the mushroom. And maybe it's part of the appeal. My friend Phoebe Frigoli-Doyle has brilliantly described the erotics of translation, claiming that desire arises precisely out of this frustration, leaving us clutching at our dictionary. What shall we clutch when we have trouble communicating with fungi? Meeting and befriending the mushroom is like meeting and befriending a person. There are many layers, tensions, and power plays. Who knew BDSM stood for bondage, discipline, domination, submission, and sadomycology? So my goal here is to give you a big ol' hard-on for nature, healing, and justice. How can we make this work hot, desirable, erotic? As we discussed earlier, the way the world is currently organized is an outrageous, exploitative nightmare. But the world itself is a beautiful garden which endlessly creates awe-inspiring poetry. And we must find the strength to defend it. In response to such dizzying levels of violence and greed, developing an enduring joy and a commitment to pleasure is paramount. Joy, pleasure, laughter, and friendship are all necessary for community building and movement building, on top of being essential for personal resilience. Ecosexuality, as presented by artists, scholars, and activists Annie Sprinkle and Beth Stevens, is an artistic, erotic, and political framework which allows for a communion between sexy gay fun and rigorous activism. Although they love and respect environmental activists, they observe that they can sometimes be a little uptight or very straight. So their mission, in best words, is to try and make the environmental movement a little more sexy, fun, and diverse. In this way, they exemplify Tony Cade Bambera's statement that the role of the artist is to make the revolution irresistible. On the other side of that coin, mainstream gay activism has a tendency to be self-concerned, fighting too hard for the right to marry and join the army, and not nearly hard enough for environmental justice. Their work tries to bridge both gaps, making gays into stewards of the earth, while making environmentalists gayer. Annie Sprinkle is best known for creating at the intersection of sex work, performance art, and sexual education. But for the last few decades, she, along with her wife Beth, has dedicated her life to building an ecosexual movement, notably by organizing weddings to the moon, the sun, the dirt, or the mountains. They have been at the forefront of the resistance against mountaintop removal in West Virginia, about which they have released a wonderful documentary called Goodbye Golly Mountain. To quote Annie, "It's funny because as a sex-positive porn star, I fought to keep my top off, but now I'm fighting to keep mountaintops on. I have since long championed alternative kinds of porn. Now I'm coming out as an anti-porn person, because porn takes so much electricity to run, and electricity is made largely from coal. And coal mining is destroying the mountains. All the technology is wonderful, but it is also contributing to massive pollution. I say let's get rid of porn and go fuck in the woods. Let's go to live sex shows in nature as an alternative to porn. Well, you know, if you're interested in organizing a fuckfest in the woods, you know, just slide in my DMs. Their main suggestion is simple. Quote, "We realize that we anthropomorphize nature, give it human qualities. We are suggesting that we switch the metaphor from Earth as mother to Earth as lover. We can't keep sucking from the mother's tit forever. We have to find more mutual ways of relating to nature." End quote. And of course, when they reject this Earth as mother, it's not an absolute. That would be extremely disrespectful to countless cultures across the world who have a Mother Earth included in their creation stories. But as Beth puts it, we don't all get along with our mothers, and some of us could use another metaphor to play with. And their suggestions of better behaviors to adopt with our newfound lover are pretty simple as well. 1. Engage with the earth as a lover and partner who we tend to care for and respect in a mutual relationship where we give more than we take. 2. Be as intentional about sex as we are about what kind of foods we eat, which products we buy, and what plants we sow in the garden. 3. Allow ourselves to experience the sensual in nature and the nature in our sensuality. 5. Give ourselves in service to the lands that feed us, the ecosystem that keep us healthy, and the communities that support us. And finally, love our bodies as ecosystems and our ecosystems as bodies. They also intend to remind us that we are not separate from nature. So when we make love to each other, we are making love to the earth. If you think about it, when you have sex with a person, you're having sex with water. Humans are made up of 70% water and stardust and microbes. So really, all sex is eco-sex. Anderlini D'Orofrio, a friend of Beth and Annie and fellow ecosexual researcher, suggests that orgiastic behavior, like that of bacteria, our first and common ancestor, is evolutionarily rewarded. She also highlights that the etymology of Gaia is literally gay. Nature is fundamentally, intrinsically bisexual or pansexual and orgiastic. I'm now going to read through Beth and Annie's Ecosex Manifesto because, well, I agree with it. We are the ecosexuals. The earth is our lover. We're madly, passionately, and fiercely in love, and we're grateful for this relationship each and every day. In order to create a more mutual and sustainable relationship with the earth, we collaborate with nature. We treat the earth with kindness, respect, and affection. We make love with the earth. We are aquaphiles, terraphiles, pyrophiles, and aerophiles. We shamelessly hug trees, massage the earth with our feet, and talk erotically to plants. We are skinny dippers, sun worshippers, and stargazers. We caress rocks, are pleasured by waterfalls, and admire the earth's curves often. We make love with the earth through our senses. We celebrate our e-spots. We are very dirty. We are a rapidly growing global community of ecosexuals. This community includes artists, academics, sex workers, sexologists, healers, environmental activists, nature fetishists, gardeners, business people, therapists, lawyers, peace activists, ecofeminists, scientists, educators, revolutionaries, critters, and other entities from diverse walks of life. Some of us are sex ecologists, researching and exploring the places where sexology and ecology intersects in our culture. As consumers, we aim to buy less. When we must, we buy green, organic, and local. Whether on farms, at sea, in the woods, or in small towns or large cities, we connect and empathize with nature. We are eco-sex activists. We will save the mountains, waters, and skies by any means necessary, especially through love, joy, and our powers of seduction. We will stop the rape, abuse, and the poisoning of the earth. We do not condone the use of violence, although we recognize that some ecosexuals may choose to fight those most guilty for destroying the earth with public disobedience, anarchist and radical environmental activist strategies. We embrace the revolutionary tactics of art, music, poetry, humor, and sex. We work and play tirelessly for earth justice and global peace. Bombs hurt. Ecosexual is an identity. For some of us, being ecosexual is our primary sexual identity. Whereas for others, it is not. Ecosexuals can be LGBTQI, heterosexual, asexual, and or other. We invite and encourage ecosexuals to come out. To come out. We are everywhere. We are polymorphous and polyamorous. We educate people about ecosex culture, community, and practices. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that we are all part of, not separate from, nature. Thus, all sex is ecosex. And now it's time for the ecosex pledge. I promise to love, honor, and cherish you, Earth, until death brings us closer together forever. So now that we've defined ecosexuality, let's complexify it. Kim Talbert is a Sisseton Wahpeton Oyate researcher specializing in racial politics and science, indigenous science and technology studies, and sexuality. She also teaches at the University of Alberta and holds the first ever Canada Research Chair in Indigenous Peoples, Technoscience, and Environment. She presents non-monogamy as a decolonial way to practice sex and relations, which implies two things. I can't possess another human being with whom I am in relation as private property. But further, I make kin with non-human beings and objects, and I can't own them either. Therefore, land, water, air, lichen, bees, and the sun are our kin. Quote, the goal is to disaggregate so-called sexuality, not back to tradition, not forward into progress, but into and back out into that spider's web of relations, or any net visual, why not mycelium, that works for you. That is a web or net in which relations exchange power, and power is intention, thus holding the web or community together. End quote. Talbert doesn't really relate to the ecosexual identity because of the way she was raised. There was no separation between the self and nature, a wound which requires tactics of reconnection like ecosexuality. Her sense of the erotic and the relational is already tied to nature because she knows herself to be an integral part of nature. She's already familiar with oneness. Although she doesn't identify as an ecosexual, she supports the movement and views it as an interesting entry door into environmental justice and land defense for settlers. She adds, quote, Annie and Beth's art and activism, like Audre Lorde's erotic, prompt us to deconstruct the concept of sexuality. Ecosexuality is theoretically generative for an Indigenous studies analysis of sex and relations, precisely because it is not necessary for Indigenous people who have much longer standing intimate relational frameworks to guide relations with lands and waters. She also discusses ecosexuality with her students. Questions and discomfort emerge, notably regarding the appropriative potential of ecosexuality, through which settlers might allow ourselves to claim land. Perhaps similarly to how heterosexuality as a system expects and encourages men to claim their girlfriend, as if love required ownership, or as if love was a pretext to justify ownership. Most often, the students who voice these concerns are non-Indigenous. She recalls a moment in class when a non-Indigenous student raised the question of consent. Okay, so if we're ecosexual, why do we assume that the tree consents to be sexualized? How can nature consent to being our partner? If we want to make Earth our lover, how can we know if it wants us back? An Indigenous student burst out laughing and answered that our human notions of consent don't apply to nature, certainly not under the same framework. Does the rain ask for my consent before getting me wet? I do not hold the answers to such queries. From where I'm standing, it is relevant to bring up the question of consent, but we should approach it differently than we would human consent. Since the inception of the capital scene, white supremacist empires have established an extractivistic, abusive relationship with the earth. Even without the confirmation of verbal consent, we know these violations to be harmful, yet they are still performed. There is here, undoubtedly, some notion of rape, of malicious, penetrative violence, where we actively suck dry, abuse, and deplete. Mushrooms are not always innocent and kind. There are three main ways that mushrooms stay alive. Saprobic mushrooms feed on dead matter. Parasitic mushrooms feed on living matter, sometimes killing their target. And mycorrhizal mushrooms develop a mutually beneficial symbiotic relationship with trees and plants. The mycelium provides water and minerals through the roots, and in return, the tree provides sugar. So what happens is fungal tubes stretch up towards the tree roots and tell the tree in their chemical language, "Hey, I'm around, and I want to merge with you, baby. I got what you need. Will you please soften your roots so I can invade your root system?" And the tree gets the message, and it answers in return. "Sounds good. Yeah, I can do that. I can start softening my cell walls and make room for you." Honestly, that is so fucking hot. "Are you ready to receive me? Will you please soften your walls so I can penetrate you?" The tree consents to this sexy offer because it's good for both of them. Because they're both excited to receive what they need, there is a loosening and an exchange. This is inspiring in terms of biomimicry as we try to learn lessons from our non-human kin. Ultimately, ecosexuality has allowed me and countless others to meaningfully engage with complex issues of environmental justice without sacrificing playful enthusiasm. On the contrary, ecosexuality has taught me that play and pleasure are a fundamental part of a good life spent doing good work. We gather as horny sluts who love the earth and its critters. Together, we imagine how sweet it could be, and then we manifest it through ritual. Let's call that magic. Let's call that ecosexual futurism. So joining me today to talk about mushroom erotics, I have Cade here, who I actually met because of our shared love of mushrooms. We're in class together and just figured out we're both mycophiles, and that brought us closer together, and now we're friends. So Cade is a student, an artist, a cultivator, and a forager of mushrooms, and is there anything else you want to say about yourself?
Yeah, all those things. Thank you for having me. This is going to be so fun. I first got into mushrooms probably a few years ago when I was taken morel hunting for the first time, which those mushrooms now hold a special place in my heart. And I think even before that, my roommate used to grow mushrooms, and I got a little glimpse of the process, but not as close as I would have liked to. But yeah, It's been a great ride.
So you started out with foraging and then moved on to cultivating as well?
Yeah, I started out foraging. I had only foraged morels in Michigan, in West Michigan. And yeah, it's interesting to look back on my like love of mushrooms, because sometimes I just don't know where it came from. It was just wasn't there one day and another day it was. But I took the Montreal Psychedelic Society had a workshop on how to grow mushrooms, and they sent me home with a little pamphlet. And then that's, I think, when that really started to mess around with different types of growing mushrooms. Yeah, ruminating on the relationship between eroticism or like sensuality and mushrooms, I was trying to think about just basic like similarities between the two. And I think there is a lot of similarity between like the relationship in terms of patience and care and like listening. And I think especially like feedback. Thinking about and ruminating on the similarities between like ecosexual relationships and between fungi, and especially in the realm of cultivation, I think there are a lot of similarities between just the care and patience and listening and kind of feedback, because when you're growing mushrooms, you, and like I guess plants in general, you're trying to listen to the mushrooms as much as possible, so that they can, you know, like communicate with you in the ways that they know how. I think the same goes for when you're like engaging in sexuality with, let's say, another person to start, you know, like when you maybe like touch a person a certain way and you're like always looking at, you know, their reaction to that, whether they have a scrunched up face or whether they like take a deep breath or whether how much they like that, and like having that guide your response like again to them.
So getting to know your mushrooms is kind of like getting to know a lover.
Yeah, it's a process of, I mean, it's also like in the playful way, like confusing and like messy in the way that like sex is. So they're humbling. It's like I said, process of patience, which I like that they are kind of like, you cannot tame me.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're easy, you know? Mm-hmm. Some mushrooms are sluts.
How would you qualify your mushrooms? Are they demanding, easy, collaborative?
Yeah, right now I think all of my mushrooms that are growing, I've probably like messed up a little bit somewhere along the way, which is fine because they can still grow fine, and it's always this process of trial and error that you can get better at. That's a really good question. I think right now what I'm growing is mainly psilocybe cubensis. They are like all of the above. They have been finicky, but they also have like, once they're ready, like will sprout so much and with multiple fleshes, and I'll be able to get a lot out of them before like I have to crumble up the substrate, which is really nice. Yeah.
Do you want to delve a little deeper into if there's anything erotic about your relationship with them?
Yeah, I think there are, of course, like really direct erotic things about cultivation, like the process of inoculation, where you inject the needle into the soaked substrate, whether, you know, that's a bag or a jar, whatever you're working with, like the innuendo is a little unmissable.
You penetrate something moist.
Yeah, you're ejaculating the spores into the bag that's wet and squishy or whatever, you know, you're working with to make like a fruiting body, you know, that'll, and I originally thought that that kind of like fertility analogy was a little bit ironic because I thought that all mushrooms produce asexually, but then I learned that most of them produce both asexually and sexually, which was super interesting. And in a lot of like the nitty gritty sciencey parts that I don't fully understand yet, I learned that mushrooms are like homophilic they are heterophallic and they are like also hermaphrophallic, meaning they're hermaphroditic. So yeah, mushrooms are intersex, mushrooms are homosexuals. It's really interesting and rare to see, like, at least in like the plant kingdom, this thing where there's a lot of like incompatibility in the sexual like ecology of mushrooms, and they sometimes will only produce their sexual organs if they are near mating partners. Can sometimes procreate with each other, kind of like slugs, like they'll both impregnate each other at the same time. The other thing that I really love to connect with mushrooms and ecosexuality is this idea of endless exploration. I think things like the body and sex and the existence of mushrooms and fungi have been around for forever, and we've talked about them forever, and we're still making art and writing and theorizing about sex and our bodies and our relationships to each other. And I think it's so wonderful how mushrooms are still like so fascinating, and I think that's something that has kept me going through mushrooms. Like having a lot of hobbies and kind of quitting them, mushrooms have been able to really like hold all this knowledge and this potential for endless exploration, where I'm always learning about them and always being like fascinated and blown away and like shocked by what they can do. And then the ways that we change our relationship to them as well. Like, you know, now how we're reading amazing things about, you know, mushrooms being turned into leather or like, you know, recyclable materials or fueling things, like, is this like wonderful endless exploration that goes back to this idea that, like, you know, you can't fully know me, and I am this like wonderful, like, outside of your realm, you know, thing that just makes it so inviting and so wonderful, in the same way that we're always learning about sex and enjoying it differently and changing our relationship to it, for sure. But you can also project on it, and you can always find reflections of the self in nature. And that's why you can just be like, yeah, mushrooms are kinky, you know, like the bleeding tooth fungus. You're like, yeah, that mushroom is like this bloody kink, playful thing. Or like all of the milk caps, you know, just like cutting them a little bit and they'll like lactate. You're just like, yeah, you can do that. And also I think, yeah, sex on mushrooms can be great.
Okay, this is groundbreaking. I'm just going to repeat what you just said, which is that the bleeding tooth is a metaphor for vampire bloodlust kink. And that the milky caps are metaphor for, like, breastfeeding kinks?
Yeah, mommy kinks.
That's fucking genius. Made me think of the first and only time I ate matsutake. And it's just this fascinating mushroom, which is kind of repulsive, but also extremely attractive. And once someone sees matsutake, is enamored, smells actually matsutake, is enamored, becomes enamored with it, they are obsessed. And there are matsutake studies and departments of matsutake studies specifically, because it is such this singular phenomenon in nature that is so gross and so attractive simultaneously. And it has this, and I've always kind of heard the legends about matsutake, and could only kind of imagine what it would feel like and smell like and taste like. And once I had it in front of me, the first thing I thought once I opened the paper bag and smelled it was that it was so genital-like. So genital-like. That was so familiar that immediately I opened it, I was like, oh, dick, you know? And it's fascinating because it's this like phallic fruiting body which emerges out of the soil, which could even be described as kind of like God's penis, like bursting out with life, with spores, just like ejaculating, as you said earlier, ejaculating spores all over, and with the aim of always living on, always, always reproducing, always, always multiplying.
Yeah.
And
that is amazing. I think that, that's crazy. I want to learn more about that mushroom. I think it's always interesting when we struggle to find language to describe mushrooms and like what they are, because they're just kind of this like enigma that surrounds it, or like you're talking about this phenomena that, you know, people just become enamored with it. Mm-hmm. And to what you said about like the genitalia, it's like obviously so many mushrooms look like dicks, and that's amazing. And then there are also like jelly fungus, you know, woodier or like amber jelly that is really wet and slimy on that grows on like dead wood that you know, when you rub your finger over it, it just like slops around, and it's just all these like labia folds and everything. Yeah. And it just always reproduces like they're just so intrinsically sexual.
Yeah.
And like give such this life to this constant exploration of sexuality. And, like, the fungi kingdom.
Yeah.
They're magic.
Would you have anything to say about kind of the potential for healing and mental health of growing, you know, DIY psilocybin cultivation at home for people who struggle with depression or anxiety?
Yeah, I think that a lot of people have found, obviously, psilocybin to some extent great for their mental health. And I think in the same way that, you know, growing a garden, like you just have a pride and sense of accomplishment and sense of fulfillment. And I think taking care of something has always been pretty healing for me, and watching it grow and then, you know, being able to, you know, dabble in the fruits literally of its labor. Psilocybin is so like endlessly fascinating to me. I think something that often bothers me about mushroom foraging specifically is this like secrecy of people's mushroom spots. I am not down with that.
Yeah.
I'll tell you all my mushroom spots and please tell me yours. And I think like if we want to think about mushrooms and specifically psychedelic mushrooms as like this outer worldly thing, we can't you know, keep it to ourselves or like confine it in these ways that capitalism often does with secrecy. And I think that's why, I mean, growing mushrooms and selling them, I think, is fine. And, you know, we're all trying to make it and, you know, share the mush. But like, at least the knowledge and things about that, like, I learned it from other people and it's not mine. And it's like, I feel this duty to, you know, give it to other people, especially if people so often talk about the feeling that mushrooms give you are like one of like oneness and wholeness with everybody, and to like, you know, hide a recipe or things like that, or not share like your best mushroom tips or yeah, your spots are just, you know, you want to be inherently anti-capitalist with this thing that you want to give back at that level that that mushroom is giving you, which I think is really important. It's been like also kind of fulfilling, and I feel like you're just kind of doing the right thing with them as you do it, and like honoring the mushroom and what it's giving you in that way.
Exactly, because if there's one thing that I know about mushrooms is that they're not down with private property.
Yeah.
Well, Cade, this was a joy.
It was.
A profound joy, as always.
Yeah.
Chit-chat about mushrooms with you.
It's been great. Thank you so much for having me.
As much as there is grief, there is gratitude. Connecting more deeply with nature as a city guy happened through ecosexuality, psychedelics, and mycology. It felt like waking up, like discovering faith. But it also hurt so much. It hurt like torture, like anger, like betrayal, like hell. My friend Onrad met a swamp last summer and asked if they could sample a bit of its water to make an elixir. The swamp spoke really slowly, but eventually agreed and added, "Things are very difficult for us. Very difficult. I can feel the pain, feel the poison. The situation is critical. A lot of violence has happened, and a lot more to come. But, you know, I'm a swamp. I can't do more. I can't go faster. I have my own rhythm. And the same goes for you. You have your own rhythm. Keep working at your own scale and at your own pace. I love this story. It really stayed with me. If you do take the time to listen to nature, you really get some good advice. My story of getting to know a non-human is about Phil. Phil the Weeper. He's a big willow tree in Jerry Park, and he's been so consistently reassuring, gentle, loving, and kind through the years we've spent hanging out. I like sitting on his lap, hugging him, climbing him. I look at him when I ice skate on the pond. I go to him when I'm feeling down. I make offerings once in a while. I pray at his roots at night. I've been blessed by his support. It's a privilege to know him. I recently learned that trees have a heartbeat, which pulsates once every hour approximately, bringing nutrients from the soil upwards. Trees also have a personality, a vibe. This is the way God appears to me. I find God when I climb trees, caress mushrooms, and admire flowers. The Ashvata is an inverted tree described in the Upanishads, a sacred Hindu text, which takes roots upwards and wraps around the heavens, and then grows its branches and leaves downwards, wrapping around the earth. You'll notice it's shaped exactly like the nervous system. Creation is here imagined as a descending movement. This orientation, this tendency, is desire. The flower wants light and then leans towards it. It has a tendency. What is the body's tendency? The body's tendency is in accordance with that of nature. It wants what's in nature's best interest, and vice versa. Collective healing is impossible without individual healing. Individual healing is impossible without collective healing. They are interdependent, always have, and always will. Listening to nature is also listening to our nervous system. Listening to our nervous system is also listening to nature. Both can co-regulate together and find unity through attunement, through just vibing, bro. The most crucial finding I've made in this research process, at least from my perspective, is that ecosexuality can be used as a tool for healing sexual trauma. Another research topic I focus on is childhood sexual abuse, and I always kind of struggle to see how it fit in with other interests of mine and how I could connect them all in an interdisciplinary way. My direct experience of what can be called ecotherapy, this appeasement of my nervous system that happens when I spend time in nature, has proved that there is, indeed, a connection. In 95% of cases, perpetrators of childhood sexual abuse know the child personally, caring for them in one way or in another, family, school, or kindergarten staff, neighbors, friends of the family. This violation of their role as caretaker breaks trust in a way that forever alters the survivor's ability to safely attach to their loved ones. For some, it's very difficult to open up to potential partners in order to develop and maintain fulfilling sexual and romantic relationships. Betrayal trauma runs deep, distorting our capacity to relax and enjoy ourselves. But you can always trust the Earth in a way you might not be able to trust another human being. Nature holds you, loves you unconditionally, nourishes you, protects you, disciplines you, comforts you. She's the mother of all mothers, the lover of all lovers. You can co-regulate safely with her. You can cry in her arms. You can come on her hand. You can offer her all the devotion contained within your beautiful body. And you can take some of her many gifts with modesty and moderation. I'm never really lonely, as long as the earth is here to hold me. As long as we've got each other's backs, there will be moments of grace. We will enter the ecstatic realm. As long as the glimmer of life can be perceived, however faintly, there is duty to protect it and wonder at its marvel. I love life. I commit to life. I surrender to life. Surrender with me.
Hold your head up, lift the top of your mind, put your eyes on the earth, lift your heart to your own home planet. What do you see? What is your attitude? Are you here to improve or damn it? Look right now, and you will see we're only here by the skin of our teeth as it is. So take heart and take care of your link with life. So take heart and take care of your link with life. It's beautiful if you got the sense to take care of your source of perfection. Mother Nature, she's the daughter of God and the source of all protection. Look right now and you will see she's only here by the skin of her teeth as it is. So take heart and take care.
CKUT's 2021 virtual funding drive, Sowing the Seeds of Grassroots Change, came to a close on Sunday, March 28th, and we are overjoyed to let you all know that we've surpassed our initial goal of $25,000 and have raised a little over $30,000 to date. As always, we're accepting donations year-round. Thank you to our listeners for continuing to support grassroots community media. Your donations and support underline our mandate of people-powered radio. If you made a pledge but have not yet paid, please do so by May 1st to be eligible for our prize draw.
Amanda broadcast tonight is a replaying of our program from 27 January this year.
Good evening, Amandla and Amandla listeners around the world. Welcome to Amandla, our weekly African current affairs program, produced both in English and in French, on air since 1987 here at CKUT 90.3. My name is Helden, and as usual, I'm sitting virtually across from Doug and Gwen. And how are you guys doing today? And if you could talk about what we have lined up today on this lovely last Wednesday of January 2021.
Thank you, Helden. So Doug and I had an opportunity to interview Fareed Omar, who is a longstanding contributor to Amandla. He's a member of the Group for Research and Initiative for the Liberation of Africa. And we re-interviewed him today about the situation in Ethiopia. So we had spoken to him a few weeks back. And today, on the basis of an article that he wrote on the role of neoliberalism in this conflict, we had an op-